Hi there. Welcome to another edition of Truth in Rhythm. This is the interview show that gets deep in the pocket with contemporary music's foremost masters of the groove. I'm your host, Scott, Dr. Jake Skolfine, musicologist and author of Everything Is on the One, The First Guide to Funk. If you don't have your copy, be sure to pick one up. It's available at Amazon and it's chock full of all kinds of funky goodness. So you don't want to miss that if you don't have a copy. Buy one for a friend makes a great gift. Whether you're watching Truth and Rhythm today through YouTube or at funkinstuff.net, or some episodes are also on Vimeo, or listening through iTunes or many other podcast providers to the audio version, I thank you so much as always for your continued interest and support in Truth and Rhythm. Speaking of which, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Actually on YouTube, it's the Funkin' Stuff channel on YouTube. That's where Truth and Rhythm resides, and also where you get Truth and Rhythm quick takes and all kinds of other good stuff. So subscribe, tell a friend, tell family, get everybody involved, support this program. We much appreciate it. This episode features one of the most finely crafted and orchestrated funk soul disco bands of the late 1970s and 1980s, Clear. That's K-L-triple-E-R, Clear. On hand to discuss their legacy are founding guitarist singer Richard Lee and keyboardist saxophonist Eric Rohrbaugh. Founded in New York in 1972 as the Jam Band, Lee and the rest of the group would serve as the backing band for several artists and undergo several name changes that included Pipeline and the Universal Robot Band. That was before they released their first Clear album for Atlantic Records in 1979. That disco-heavy debut was called I Love to Dance and included the fierce dance club track Keep Your Body Working. Settling more firmly into a funk R&B blend, Clear would go on to cut six more albums for Atlantic between 1979 and 1985. Their popularity peaked with Winners. That album reached number 24 on the US R&B Albums chart, and License to Dream, which climbed all the way to number 13. They also notched three top 40 R&B hit singles, consisting of Tonight's the Night, Winners, and Get Tough. Other key Clear tracks included Nothing Said, Open Your Mind, The Clear Ting, Where Would I Be Without Your Love, Taste the Music, The Ting Continues, Swan, Get Ready, Stonesy, Intimate Connection, and Secret. Here, in likely Clear's most in-depth interview ever, Lee and Rohrbaugh recount the glory and gory of the band's founding, rise, pinnacle, fade, and demise. One thing to make clear before proceeding are a few technical matters. A third group member, founding keyboardist composer Paul Crutchfield, was supposed to be on this particular interview, but he was not able to connect to the video session, so that was unfortunate. But we definitely want to acknowledge him here. As well, an unfortunate technical glitch was then discovered after the interview, in which Rohrbaugh's visual did not register. We only got his audio. His visual later inexplicably pops on with about a half hour left in the session. Ghost in the machine, for sure. To compensate, stills of Rohrbaugh have been added over some of his audio. And if you have to lose one or the other in these, the video or the audio, definitely prefer losing the video so we still get what they have to say. Lastly, Lee's feed was at sometimes compromised by less than ideal connectivity, resulting in lower frame rates and some audio dropouts. Therefore, a lot of painstaking post-production work has been put into this episode to make it as good as possible despite those issues. Highlights of the show include inside looks at Clear's album, songs, and shows, including sharing the stage with Prince and Rick James, among many others, an explanation of the group's unusual spelling and fascination with wordplay, and what Clear looks like today, as well as plans to produce new music. So with that, here's my very fun time with the guys from Clear. Enjoy. It is indeed a privilege to welcome to the Truth and Rhythm Mothership founding members of one of the most agile bands at seamlessly blending disco, funk, and R&B into an irresistible blend of dance tracks, which they did from 1979 to 1985. I'm talking about none other than Clear. That's K-L Triple ER. And with me today are that group's guitarist and singer, Richard Lee, and keyboardist, sax player, and percussionist, Eric Rohrbaugh. Guys, how are you? So glad to have you.
Thanks for having us over there.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
It's all good.
So first up, we're looking at Eric right now. And Eric, where are you coming to us from?
North Great River, Long Island, New York.
Excellent. And here we have Richard. And Richard, where are you coming to us from?
And I'm here from Brooklyn, New York.
I'm so glad you could join me. As I was saying before we went on air, big fan. You played an important role in my DJ work in the late 70s into the 80s. Helped keep my crowds happy and the dance floor full. So I much appreciate that.
You're quite welcome for that. Quite welcome. Thanks for playing us back then. Lord, if it wasn't for you guys spinning us, we wouldn't be there. We wouldn't, frankly, be coming back.
Are you guys ready to roll and actually roll way back and test your memory banks a little bit?
You know, Social Security is a wonderful thing.
let's go for it.
Oh, yeah, let's do it. Let's do this.
All right. That's what's great about having multiple band members is you guys often can help fill in the blanks with each other so we get the full
picture. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to whip each other.
Okay. Let's see.
So where are each of you from originally, and when did you first get into music? So I'll start first with Richard on that one.
Okay, now originally, I'm from Washington, D.C. And I think I started playing behind like the various singing groups and all. I mean, it was during the time when the Temptations were reigning, and I did a lot. But I think once I heard my first Sly and the Family Stone record, I think I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a band. So that's like my start in music. And then all of this was way back in 1972 or so. So it's been a little while. No, but to tell you the truth, you look back on it now and it's really fun times. You know, all of it, you know. You know, you kind of miss it.
Did you have a musical household to an extent? And did you end up getting any guitar lessons or self-taught?
Well, I'm self-taught. Now, the strange thing about it is that my mother used to sing. But my mother sang Judy Garland records. And she was, I thought my mother should have gone and sang Judy Garland records because she could sing just like Judy Garland. And she played all the jazz stuff. As a matter of fact, the producer that we ended up with, Emir Diodato, he basically was, part of the music in my house, the girl from Ipanema from Brazil, Brazilian jazz and stuff like that. So I grew up listening to a lot of Brazilian jazz and Miles Davis and Judy Garland stuff. So I don't know. I think I just liked all the music at some point. No, but no, I'm self-taught. And there was a whole crew of band people in Washington, D.C. I mean, musicians, singers and all. So there was always a lot of people. I had a set of cousins which played in, which sang in one of the old singing groups called the Unifics. And the Unifics, basically, they had a couple of big records back in the 70s. And I think that too is what helped me get into it. But mostly Sly and the Family Stone, you know? Yeah.
Very good. Eric, what's your beginning story?
I started watching my brother take piano lessons. I guess I was probably about 5 or 6 years old. And Miss Gibney would pull up in her 1950 Ford convertible with the top down. And she come in, they do their little thing. And I'm sitting off to the side watching. I said, oh, that looks like fun. So I started that in an early age. My father was, he actually played clarinet. He was big into jazz. He was always telling me about the bass player and going, dum, 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 dum. He loved that. And my mom sang. I still have an old record of hers that she sang on to her mother for Christmas. And So as we got on in, I guess it was in elementary school, I guess, probably around fourth grade in elementary school in the early 60s. I started with the clarinet, ended up being first chair. And then they needed a sax player. And because I was a big fellow, they gave me a tenor saxophone in sixth grade. In seventh grade, I got a baritone saxophone. And now it's getting to the point where I have a Selma Parris Mark VI tenor from 58 and a Selma Parris Barry. And I had taken, my father got me lessons with the saxophone with George Coleman, the black jazz saxophonist. And that was 2 years of that. That was around 66 to 68, 69, somewhere in there. And then, because I also played piano, 65, they bought me my first piano. It was an upright Yamaha, an M1 piano, wonderful keyboard. And I had my own piano lessons. One was about 2.5 years with Steven Sven Grauski. He was a classical pianist out here in the East. He taught in the schools here. And then I also had jazz piano with Wes Bolkavich. He passed on a few years ago, unfortunately. But so I've had some schooling with that keyboard and sax, both classically and with jazz instructors. So that was always in the family. My father, I remember, you know, he'd have the parties that you always had in the 60s back in those days. And he had a wide collection, very eclectic collection of records. I still have most of the records. Half of them disappeared. My wife got rid of them. Those things happen. But I have a lot of them. And interestingly enough, back then, it wasn't just jazz that he was listening to. Very little of the Elvis Presley stuff. He was listening to, I have things I'm listening to from the Africa, where I have these different percussive beats that I'm listening to. Some music from Egypt, even. And I'm listening to these different scales and the different sounds that you would get out of these different percussive instruments and all that, along with the pop music now, getting into the late 60s. And I'm listening to that, along with these other things in my head. And it just kept, you know, moving forward with that. And then into the synthesis, of course, I didn't have study with synthesizers other than working them. I had one of the early Mini Moog synthesizers, Oberheim four voice synthesizer. I had a two voice Oberheim myself. And it was very interesting to see how the different parameters, I would think of a sound and understand the parameters of the synthesizer, the oscillators, the filter banks and whatnot. And you don't try, see, the misconception of synthesizers is people think, oh, they're going to take away the orchestra, you're going to do that. No. Electronic synthesizers are just that. They were a new instrument. And that's the way I always approached synthesizers, as it's just a new instrument. I'm not putting anybody out of business. It's a new instrument. Mm-hmm. And that's my approach to synthesis. And so, you know, listening to, you know, Chick Corea, yeah. Herbie Mann, mm-hmm. Rick James, you know, there's so many groups I can't even think of, you know, who, what, where, and how. McCoy Tyner, I love him. It's just a lot of these folks just really hit me. And then when we got into, okay, you're going to go to college or you're going to go play music? I was a school of hard knocks. While I had some private schooling, I wanted to go out and play. I wanted to perform and I wanted to do my own thing mm-hmm. on the stage and with my own music. So late 60s, to get out there and play, a friend of mine, Ray Rivera, and I, we put together this group called Traction, and we were playing within the first month that Santana came out in 69. We had the entire album down. Dad, I need a Hammond organ. He went out and bought me a Hammond organ with the Twin Leslies. And we had that down, and we were playing for a McGovern rally, and everybody thought we were Santana because Ray looks like Carlos Santana with the guitar and all. So we were doing that. We were doing some Allman Brothers material, War, just a lot of eclectic music, and we always had the full percussion, even back then. Something you probably didn't know there, Rick. We had a timbali player. I had all the little hand percussion things off to the side, and we had a wonderful conga player who would play three drums on the floor He'd pick them up and throw them in the air and buy them and bring them down. Quite the showman. He had passed on because of bad things he was doing back then, drug-wise. It's a shame that the drugs are terrible. You don't do that and survive. But, yeah, so it just brought me up to this here situation where I was playing with another group on Red Grick Records. And, you know, the guys were saying that, you know, the Universal Robot Band, which is the name of Clear prior to it being Clear. Remember that, Rick? And this fella, Jerome couldn't make this one particular trip out on the road, and they needed a keyboard player to fill in. So that's how I got into Clear. It was around 77 or so. I was actually a, you know, a fill-in keyboardist for them. And once we were on the road and playing, they decided to keep me on board. So that's when I became a full-fledged member of Clear. And the rest is history.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Eric. Rolling back a few years before Eric became part of that ensemble with you, Rick, at what point did you come into the picture? Because my understanding is that there was an entity called the Jam Band around 72 that was the precursor of the precursors. When did you get into the picture, Rick?
Okay. I was in the picture from day one. But what we did was we went through several name changes because from time to time, when we first came to New York City, we were a backup band called the Choice Four Incorporated behind the singing group. But then when we decided to like actually do, you know, just some work off on the side, we would always change our name. The Jam Band was one of the names which we worked under. And sometimes we would talk about recording and stuff. And but, you know, we actually recorded under, it was the Jam Band, then it was the Universal Robot Band. We actually recorded a whole disco album, you know, which was like, you know, just something to do. Because at this point up in New York, we were just trying to survive and be able to eat. So, you know, the more you play, the more, you know, the better you ate. And I think that had a lot to do with, you know, whatever name which we thought of, I think that's what, you know, we would go ahead and use that. So the Jam Band just happened to be one of the names that we dealt with, you know, but
it was you also, the same guys. Also as a group called Pipeline, is that right too?
Yeah, the Pipeline was the same group of guys. We had, at first we had another keyboard player, Jerome Talbert, but Jerome left, and that's how we got Mr. Eric, and Eric replaced Jerome. But yeah, the Pipeline, that was the three, that was let me see, Richard Lee, Norman Durham, Woody Cunningham, and then it was Jerome Talbert. And I think when we first came up to New York, that was one of the names that we tried, because we were trying to be like a funk rock band. Until we realized that most record companies didn't know what to do with a funk rock band. You know, they wanted you to even be straight up R&B or even straight up rock. And we were somewhere in the middle. And I don't ever think we, we made a decision, you know, we just played what we felt at the time. So things didn't work out with the New York record companies, although, you know, we kept dealing with them. And finally, you know, Atlantic Records did work out. But it was just one of those things to where if we needed to do a job and we needed, you know, needed a band name, hey, we would change the name. So Pipeline was one of them.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, my CREC research team of myself, getting ready for talking to you guys today, I went back and I listened to the Pipeline record, Gypsy Rider. I was not familiar with it before then. Definitely heard a Hendrix and War influence in that song. I don't know if you remember what it sounded like, but it was... Gypsy Rider.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gypsy Rider was written by We had another guitar player at the time, a guitar player named Chuck Thompson. And it was just one of the songs which we kind of tried to funk up a little bit, but it really was a straight rock song. And to me, it was just a fun song. I like the song, so we would do it. But yeah, that was one of the things that we would do. That was back when, you know, it just seemed like the record companies didn't know what to do. You know, with a black R&B funk rock band, you know. So we just went with whatever, you know, however we could do it. But we really just played whatever, you know, that we wanted to play, you know.
And this, the Universal Robot Band, there's a song, Barely Breaking Even, which was pretty successful. And to me, I can definitely hear the makings of a Clear, you know, within that. Do you guys agree with that or see that?
Well, you know, some of that time, because I'm going to tell you, a lot of that time, I mean, we really were, when we came up to New York, you know, we were on our own. So things like eating and paying rent was basically on our own. I mean, you know, it wasn't like a big contract thing where we all got front money and we would borrow money to go to the studio to record the first album, which I think a lot of musicians know about that. You know, when you're just making it day by day, but you know, that's part of it. So
push along.
Yeah, that's what it was about. Barely making.
Yeah. Oh, and then how did the Clear name get created? You know, how did you decide on that? And how was it that you finally got Atlantic to give you guys a deal?
We came at Atlantic two times. We met a record masterer, one of the masterers, one of the guys who actually put the record, the sound on the vinyl. His name was Dennis King. And Dennis King, you know, he listened to us first when we were a rock band and we were just like Pipeline. And he tried, you know, we recorded a couple of things and we submitted it to Atlantic and we really got, we really didn't get too much from that. But a few years passed and I think we met Dennis King again. Mm-hmm. And we gave him some funkier stuff. And that's basically how we got onto Atlantic Records, because Atlantic Records was doing a whole little thing. Well, it was just before Chic and Sister Sledge and that whole thing came on. We were there like 78, 79. And we put out, and we recorded Keep Your Body Working on a, it was really, I forgot what the record companies called it,
but acetate.
It would make you, yeah.
Yeah, that's acetate. Correct. Yeah.
It was
acetate.
Really of all the new groups that they had, and we were like one of about nine different groups on there. In some kind of way, our record Keep Your Body Working kind of stuck out, and which was something, because we had really recorded it on a bunch of old Atlantic 8-track equipment that one of the guys that worked in Atlantic had in his garage in in Long Island. You know, so it was really something that we put together, and all of a sudden it came out, and that started our first album deal with Atlantic Records.
What, how and who decided on the name Clear, and how was it decided it was going to be spelled as it's spelled, and do you remember?
Oh, wow. Well, you know,
I can't help you with that.
when all of us guys came up from the South, I think we had we had a lot of slang, and we got to a point to where we were often talking around people who we didn't want to know exactly what we were saying. So when something was positive and something that we agreed with, we just looked at each other and said, "Clear, clear, clear." Okay. But it kind of held on. So like when we put the band together, we were thinking that we were trying to put together, you know, a really truthful, honest type of situation. One that you could see through, because you know, Clear was just positivity. It was just something that we could, you know, we could all agree on. And basically, if you look at all the songs about Clear was like, you know, self-help songs and stuff that would help.
That's right. That's right.
We were never talking about going out, you know, and hurting anybody. It was always going out and doing something that felt good that would help.
Always a positive message.
So that's where Clear came from. It just came from positivity, and that's what Clear meant to us. Now the way we spelled, I think that was just one of those nights where maybe a little tequila was involved or something. I don't know. I'm not sure. But you know, it's just one of those times that we just when we first started talking about Clear, you know, and the way it was spelled, I was like, okay, great, because I knew we had to spell it differently from what it was. We had to try to make it look good. So, KLEER.
I was trying to think of which tequila has three E's. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know, but you know,
I wouldn't mind you finding
drink
out.
Enough of it.
You know,
I think that's how it
is. Yeah, I mean, it's always fascinating to me because, you know, using the K wasn't enough. You guys went with the three E's also. And then you carried that three E's through to so many of the song titles whenever you would use the E's and stuff. So.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Yeah. That became a whole thing.
Yeah. It just became a thing. Well, because, I mean, a lot of times when we were together, it was a lot of laughing and joking. And, you know, I mean, in between the arguments, of course.
It kind of finalized things at the end of a discussion. It's like, are we clear? And everybody just go, clear.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was a positive thing. Okay, we're all done. You know, no animosity. Everybody understand we're on track. And it'd be clear.
Uh-huh.
And that's how that was it. It really stuck. To this day, we still use that.
Well, I think it's evident not just in the message and the vibe to me, but also in the sound that you guys developed, you know, a very crisp and clear sound too.
We always tried to be uplifting in whatever we did.
Yeah.
Always wanted a positive message. There was enough negativity out there in the music. Everything that Clear did was always positive. You can do better. Yeah. If that's all you got, that's good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just keep going forward. Work it. And you'll get to where you want to be, a happy place.
Clear. Absolutely. So that first track, Keep Your Body Working, of course, great classic song. And, you know, it led to the I Love to Dance album in 1979. What do you guys remember about putting that record together and the experience of getting your first album out? So let me turn first to Eric to talk about that.
Yeah, the first album that I was involved with, I've never been in a studio such as Atlantic. And Rick, do you remember it was at the Atlantic studio up on 62nd, something like that, or 61st Street near Columbus Circle?
Yeah, up.
It was up.
Yeah, Columbus Circle.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I had never been in that type of a studio. And to go into that studio and see this equipment and then put on the headphones, I was always used to playing live, you know, so then to have. Okay, in fact, I still have the original headphones from that studio that I used. And you put the cans on and you're listening to it. And what really struck me first, Scott, never having recorded in such an existence, is you're listening to the thing, it sounds like you're listening to an album. But guess what? You're playing your part live. So if you botch something up, it's like, what was that? And they say, that was you. So, you know, that I caught on to that quickly. It's like, okay, just get into it and play it as if we're on stage playing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, what type of instrument are you looking for? I want this. I want that. I came in one day because I loved the Oberheim synthesizer. It was a warm sound. And not many guys, except like maybe Joe Zawinul or Herbie Hancock, would be using such an instrument. They're very difficult to use, especially live. And it's such a warm sound. So on Get Tough, I believe it was, right, Rick? Was it Get Tough where we used the four-voice Oberheim, which I programmed? Yeah. And that brass. And it was just It was magical in the studio. I really enjoyed my time in the studio. The more we did it, the other thing in that particular song, the it became kind of like, I noticed that Dennis put that up front as Rick. I think you still have the original sand blocks that I used back then. There was not mechanical hand claps. We had all nine of us in the studio around a microphone with our headphones on, and we hear into the song, and it's like, they're real hand claps.
Yeah. And
one thing in the song was that doom, that doom, that doom,
okay,
and that little thing stuck, and they brought that up in the mix, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. That's just a little percussion thing that I came up with, but the vibes that was there around in that room. I'll never forget the vibes in that room. When Clear was recording that album, it was magical. I'll never forget that. I appreciate you guys for that.
Yeah, man.
Just to clarify, though, Eric, did you play on the very first album where we're talking
about? I did not.
Okay, so the first one you played on was the second one, Winners?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure we're clear on that.
From Winners on is where I was involved.
Yes. Okay.
Until I left. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Well, I'm going to probe your mind about Winners a little more in a second, but I do want to just get a little bit about that first record too. So Rick, what do you remember about getting that one out? And it must have been a thrill, right? I mean, that first album came out.
Well, yeah. Well, at first, okay, to tell you what, because see, being a funk rock band, we didn't think that one of our first records would be a disco hit primarily. I mean, it was like a whole new thing with us. But what it did was it just opened the scale up for all the different instruments, which we all loved. So most of it was, it was kind of like, wow, what can we do? Wow, what can we not do? Oh, well, let's put this in there. Oh, well, let's put that in there. And then when it got to vocals, we always wanted to be, because we had came to New York playing behind a vocal group. So to tell you the truth, we had all kind of learned harmony and backgrounds and stuff from being in the vocal group. Because I think about the time when we left, we were singing a lot of the stuff too. So at that point, it was just nice, for us to be able to really sing and put a lot of singing in it. And if you remember some of the old Sly and the Family Stone stuff, they did a lot of singing for a band. I mean, it wasn't just an ordinary little lead and little, drum beat with a bass line behind it. It was a lot of background, a lot of singing going on. So we wanted to do some of that because all of that made the song to me, So it was like we were kids in the candy shop.
It's a good way to put it, Rick.
Yeah. It was like, oh boy. I mean, I would pick up little instruments and all and be like, what's this? What's that? What's that? And we would play it because everything we wanted was always there, and there was a lot of legendary stuff there in the studio.
Well, you had some great backing players in that first band.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
you had the Brecker brothers on horns.
Luther Vandross
was in there. T.S. Monk, trumpet. Yeah, some heavy hitters.
Yeah, well, yeah. Hey, it was very, very nice like to have. And then, like I say, the orchestration, man, with the violins and stuff, was like a lesson for all of us because we learned a lot about arrangement just working with the violinist guy. So. It was like every day was kind of like a learning thing with us and we were just happy to be there. And it was just one of the times when I remember it was we would stay in the studio 12 hours, 14 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't anybody care? We were just there all day long and go to sleep for 4 or 5 hours and get up and come back, do it again. The good old days.
that first album, though, for sure, to me was the most straight ahead disco out of all the records, and could definitely hear like some Chic and GQ and that kind of like influence going through there. One track I want to mention from that first record, that, see if you recall or not, Clear Sailing, that closed that first record, was a nice mid-tempo track that to me showed a different side of the band early on. And and I appreciated that on that record. So how much was it that the label was gearing you or steering you guys more toward a disco sound, or was it more Dennis King, or, you know, how did that come about?
Well, okay. When we first appeared, we appeared on the disco charts. Okay. A lot of the radio stations started playing our stuff, and a lot of the discos started playing our stuff. We didn't purposely start out to be a disco group, but we kind of went with the first hit because, I mean, it was like, it was the first time, you know, where we could see, let's just say, a way that we could actually get on a record label and get a record contract, which was like, wow. Now the whole record Clear Sailing was kind of like, you know, we felt as though that we had fought our way up that far. And it was like, for the first time, we could see a year in advance. And because you're talking about guys who slept on floors, slept in vans and all that other stuff. And now all of a sudden, wow, we got an Atlantic record contract. So, you know, not that we were rich, but at least we could see where we were going to make money and how the future was going. And the future looked great
then. And Eric, you came then into the fold as they were doing the second record or before it, or how did that happen?
It was probably back when it was the Universal Robot Band. I filled in for Jerome, who couldn't make a certain some gigs. And I didn't hear from him after we did that little bout going around playing here and there up and down the East Coast. But then a year or two later, we reconnected, and they said that they're working with Dennis King and Atlantic Records, and they're looking for a keyboardist, and would I be interested? And I said, absolutely. I have strong interest in that, sure. And we got together, we played a little bit, and then we went into the studio, and it's like, we clicked, and it's like, okay, this is good. Let's go forward with this, you know? So that's pretty much how I got into that album. They always seemed to enjoy the fact that I did synthesizer, I did saxophone, and percussion. I did, you know, different types of things.
Versatile.
Yeah, very versatile that way, yeah. Rather than just stay on one thing.
Yeah, Eric was a triple threat, boy, with the percussion, with the percussion and the sax and the keyboard. It was like, oh, right, you know. And there were times where it was like, okay, great, now we had to figure out things, because it's like, look, he couldn't play the keyboard and the sax at the same time, you know. But it was like, hey, this is cool.
Yeah.
Like I said, at that point, it really wasn't as planned out as I would like to say it was.
It just happened.
I mean,
what happened on stage, it just happened.
A lot of it happened.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't big on rehearsal and rehearsing every note just the way it is. We would make sure everybody had the feeling, and we would try to take that to the studio.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, they gave you the freedom to do that, which was unusual. Most places would want you to play, I want you to play this exact note, this phrasing, or you're out of here. They accepted the way I heard the songs and how I would phrase things and how I would write on a couple songs some minor orchestrations for strings, and it just gelled. And that was the magic of Clear, was that the fellas they gave somebody like myself the opportunity to do this, but also the freedom to express what I'm hearing within the Clear sound and mindset. And what can I put towards this project? What can I put toward this music that they're creating? And I like to feel that, the nine of us did a good job once we got into that particular section where we had the three girls and us and Terry Dolphin on the other keyboards. It was a Russian fella. He was actually a jazz player. He played the piano, synthesizers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He also played vibes. He actually played a vibe player.
So it was a nice
musical situation.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was a very collaborative, and that Winter's album definitely was, to me, was a huge step forward in being much more cohesive and just being stronger all around.
Well, that was really the first album where Clear was kind of like an Earth, Wind, and Fire, if you will. The players in the band was the band. Prior to that, you had, you know, these other, you know, the Brecker brothers, Luther Vandross and whatnot. You had other players doing that in the studio. You know, you had Senji and his orchestra. Now we're doing this live using synthesizers to perform it live. It's a different mindset how you come across doing the synthesizers. I did the best I could with the technology at the time. Of course, the synthesis they have today, and actually, you know, my sample machines, they have actual recordings of strings. So my, because I dabbled with violin, viola, bassoon. I actually played all these instruments growing up. So I have an understanding of orchestral instruments and their part, where they belong and where they are on the musical scale. So when you play the instruments in knowing how they're phrased, and even though it's a sample, in a live environment, going through the sound systems that you have in these arenas, you can get a good duplication, you know, on the spot like that. And it seemed to work with what we were doing.
I also find it interesting, I mean, looking at the dates, that album also came out in 79. So really two Clear albums hit the streets in 79.
Pretty
and
close,
I just want to let the viewers know, you know, some of the highlights that were on this particular record. The title track, of course, also Open Your Mind.
A great tune.
Yeah, jazzy funk, you know, on that one. Yeah. And Hunger for Your Love was a real ballad, kind of for the first time. Mm-hmm. Your Way was a real nice mid-tempo track. And I got to tell you, my favorite song that really got me into Clear, I'll see how you feel about this, was Nothing Said.
That's a funky tune.
That is a fierce groove.
I
love
that
thing.
That is something. That took about 5 minutes, I think, to write.
That was a quick song.
It happened. It just happened.
That was a fun song.
It was, you know, it was one of those songs where, let's just say, that was not one of the Clear trying to uplift you songs. We were just talking about the way things were.
Let's just say that particular album, Scott, that was Clear partying in the studio. We were having a ball and we were throwing this stuff down. And we had a couple of takes that we did over here and there, but for the most part, we went in, played the damn thing. That was it. And that was the magic of that album.
Well, and that makes it all the more impressive, really, with how polished it is, you know?
We were all connecting at that point. The band was kicking tail.
Yeah.
I won't say kicking ass. I don't think I can say that.
The bass line and Nothing
Said. It was kicking tail.
The bass lines in so many of the songs are really great. But
Nothing
Said
was wonderful.
The way you have the call and response of the groove in that song.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me a little bit of Lakeside, I got to tell you. But
okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good stuff there.
And what about things like conceptually? You know, that album had sort of like trippy, Art Deco kind of like neon artwork for the cover. You know, how was that sort of stuff being developed for the group?
Remember now, Atlantic Records had a whole line of art designers and all. So basically, I think one thing which we were really, really in collaboration on was the original Clear logo, the way they actually wrote Clear out. But a lot of things were basically put to us and it would be like, hey, look, how is this? How is that? How is this? How is that? And some of it, you know, to tell you the truth, I think we tried not to overthink a lot of things. And some of that, and some of the artwork on the albums was something that we tried not to overthink with it. A lot of it came out with Atlantic's art department and all. And as long as it was something that we didn't just hate it, we were like, okay, good. Hey, let's see what that is. So that's how a lot of it worked. To tell you the truth, you know, I mean, I would like to say that we thought about it really intensely, but no, we didn't. You know, it was more of just the music on the album.
The music on the album. I guess I would say probably that the Clear logo and the artwork with the winners with the trophy on it and whatnot was that fella that was he an Argentina? I think he is, or Brazil.
Okay.
Wonderful yeah. artist. Yeah, it was that fella. They presented us this with the stuff, and we look at it and go, that works. You know, we were more into the music. That the part of promoting the situation of Clear, the group Clear, we left that to Atlantic. You know, they know what they're doing. Go for it. You know,
I thought it was interesting though that through the first two albums, even the first three, at least, you guys didn't appear on the covers at all.
Right.
Yeah. So
License to Dream on the back cover, you had the group.
I don't know. I think at some point, I remember Dennis King just kind of doing a little survey, and it was just seeing how, you know, they wanted people to like our music first before trying to put us in a certain category.
Yeah.
You know, so like if you saw a couple of black guys, then all of a sudden you went to a certain category, and Clear wasn't like that. It was an R&B band, but it was elements in Clear, and that is what we wanted to, I think, to project more so than, oh, hey, you know, we're like three or four black guys from Washington, D.C., and then we came up to New York, and now we have a whole bunch of guys with us. You know, it really wasn't about all of that. It was more we wanted to produce, you know, show the music first. And then whatever you thought about all that other stuff was like, okay, great. Sure. But, you know, as far as the picture on the album stuff, I think Dennis showed us that putting your picture on the album didn't necessarily help your sales.
Mm.
So I think that's why we didn't do it at the time. It was just,
But I think as Clear moved on, you probably had where people like, who are these guys? And you wanted to get that personal side of it. So you wanted to see who it was. So when we get to that third album where you have, License to Dream? And on the back cover, you have, there's Clear. There's the entire nine-piece band. And with everybody, mm-hmm. you know, named and whatnot. And that gives you a little indication of, okay, now we've settled into what Clear is. We're on tour with everybody, Rufus and Shaka Khan, mm-hmm. you know, name who, Sister Sledge, like you mentioned before. And these are the folks. And then, now the people have the album. They're listening to the music they love, okay? And then they go out and see us on stage, and they're like, there they are. That brought the personal thing to the people out there who liked and loved Clear enough to come see us perform. And that, when you get there, and we did some small clubs. I think we did one club with the Spinners, I think it was, in Ohio or something like that. And it was maybe about, I think it was 7,800 crowd. And so this, we're starting to get to larger places. But at the same time, we started hitting the larger Coliseums, Rick, right? We were doing like 23,000 to 27,000, 28,000 people. And you're selling the places out. And you're out there. You come out, you know, you hear the roar. And you come out on stage and you look around. It's like, dear Lord God, have mercy. This is wonderful. I'm glad we're making all these people happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we're getting, it's like, now it's our job. Okay, let's get out there and funk them to death. You know, let's get out there and do it, you know? And that was the joy of it. That was for me, that was the paycheck. Mm-hmm. It still is, you know, if we can put something together and people get joy out of that and forget about other things that is bothering them for a half hour. Okay.
We did our job.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we need more of that in the world today. There's just too much negative things. And if we can throw a little joy and positiveness like we did in the old days out there today, Lord have mercy. We need it.
Amen, Eric.